Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 49. The Return to Boston. But for Mrs. Eddy, her victory was only a breathing spell, if that. As always, apparent defeat or actual victory merely served as incentives to renewed effort on a larger scale. She had claimed the right to live her life in Concord, secluded from the world, if she so desired, without having her motives or capacity questioned, and she had won her case. She now claimed the right to reverse her policy if she had a need to. She would leave Concord and make her home in Boston. It was no hasty or whimsical decision. The movement was growing rapidly, and although Mrs. Eddy, as successive notices in the Sentinel and Journal about this time sufficiently show, was withdrawing more and more from active participation in the work, nevertheless, the new fields of activity constantly presenting themselves tended to increase rather than diminish the amount of actual labor that devolved upon her. Concord was too far away. When anything of importance was to be done, she always dealt directly with those responsible, and a trip to Concord requisitioned a whole day for something which, if she were nearer, could be dispatched in a few hours. And so, soon after the conclusion of the next friend's suit, Mrs. Eddy decided to return to Boston. As soon as the decision was taken, the project moved forward rapidly, and it was not long before negotiations were in progress for the purchase of a small estate in Chestnut Hill, in the suburbs of Boston. Formerly known as the Lawrence Estate, it comprised a large house of 25 rooms, situated on some 12 acres of well-wooded ground, and commanding a wide view across the valley of the Blue Hills. The purchase was completed late in the year, and on Sunday, January 26, 1908, this strangely venturing woman, at the age of 87, said goodbye to Pleasant View. She looked out of her study window for the last time over the river towards Bow, up the valley toward Mount Monadnock, and then set out for her new home. It was a beautiful day as she drove through Concord for the last time, snow everywhere, but the air was mild and the sun shone brightly. She walked across the station platform unaided, and as the newspapers put it, with the ease and grace of a much younger woman, to the special train waiting to take her and her household on the first stage of their journey. 3 hours later, in the red half-light of a winter evening, she drove through the gates of Chestnut Hill, which was to be her home until she died some 3 years later. Concord was sorry to see her go. The old town had known her all her life, and its people, especially in these latter years, had come to look upon her as one of their particular possessions. The appearance of her carriage on the State Street of an afternoon, summer or winter, was something that Concord, now these many years, had taken for granted. And so, a few days after she and her household had departed for Boston, the mayor and the city council met together in special session and passed resolutions of regret, causing them to be spread on the records of the city and forwarded to Mrs. Eddy at Chestnut Hill. And Mrs. Eddy promptly replied, thanking them deeply for the kindly resolutions passed by your honorable body, telling them how rich were the recollections of her associations with Concord and its good folk, and praying that she might deserve the friendship and esteem of people of my native state. But if Concord was sorry to see her go, Mrs. Eddy was sorry to leave, and many times, especially during the immediately ensuing months, must her thoughts have returned regretfully to the compact, old-fashioned house on the side of the hill which she had called her home for so long. Chestnut Hill was beautiful and convenient and supplied with the last word in everything. But it was so vast. When anyone had entered the door of her study at Pleasant View, by the time she had looked up from her desk to see who it was, he was almost beside her. But at Chestnut Hill, there seemed to be so much walking to do before anyone could come within hail of anyone else. She endured it all for a time, and then, in one of those sudden decisions, she had a way of making the moment she became convinced that something was wrong that could and should be righted, she took counsel with Calvin Fry and other members of her household. Adam Dickey, in his memoirs, describes how she clinched the matter by remarking humorously, "When I call a student to come to me, I cannot wait until he walks across such a great expanse of carpet from the door to my desk. Something must be done to conserve my time." In the end, a plan was worked out with the aid of the architect, whereby her bedroom and study were reduced to the same size as the bedroom and study in Pleasant View, and the two rooms arranged as nearly as possible the same way. The change, moreover, it was found, added greatly to the comfort of the house. It allowed Calvin Fry to have a sitting room as well as a bedroom, afforded space for an elevator, and widened the landing outside of Mrs. Eddy's study. She could almost imagine herself back again in her old home. She must have been glad of it, glad when she could think of Concord without regret, and Chestnut Hill without misgiving. For as subsequent events showed, she had great things yet to do. Of these, first place must be given to the launching of a great daily newspaper, which she was to name the Christian Science Monitor. Perhaps she had envisioned something of the sort 25 years earlier, when she said, with the first issue of the journal, that there was an urgent need for a publication devoted to counteracting the unwholesome influence of the newspapers of the world. Much water had gone under the bridge since then, but the color of the stream had not changed much. All through the history of her movement, Mrs. Eddy had suffered many things from the press generally. And while she recognized that much of the misrepresentation and sensationalism which characterized the newspaper approach to her teaching was inevitable, she must frequently have longed for some medium through which she could make known the facts as she saw them. It was plain by now that little could be done through a monthly periodical, such as the Journal, in this direction, insofar as reaching the general public was concerned. And practically nothing in presenting the news of the day in the way she felt it ought to be presented. And so, with the merciless notoriety attendant upon the next friend's suit so fresh at hand, she was prepared to regard warmly the suggestion from one John L. Wright that a general newspaper owned by Christian Scientists and conducted by experienced newspaper men who are Christian Scientists be started. Mr. Wright was first reader of the church at Chelsea, had been for 3 years substitute Night City editor of the Boston Globe, and for 15 years a reporter on that paper. From this impressive background of experience, he wrote Mrs. Eddy in March of 1908 that he was convinced a large public would be ready to support a wholesome paper that takes less notice of crime, etc., and gives attention especially to the positive side of life, to the activities that work for the good of man, and to the things really worth knowing. A few months later, in August of that year, to be exact, the trustees of the Christian Science Publishing Society received a laconic note from Chestnut Hill, signed by Mrs. Eddy, requesting that a daily newspaper be started at once, the same to be called the Christian Science Monitor. Whether the trustees knew what was involved in starting a metropolitan daily newspaper, not only in the matter of capital, but in the thousand details of management and promotion, it is impossible to say. Even if they did, there were by this time few, if any, connected with the work who would question any request from Mrs. Eddy. Experience had taught them that she never asked them to do anything until she was satisfied that it was feasible. While the rapid, orderly fulfillment of her plans had become almost a commonplace in the records of the cause. The trustees replied at once, expressing their joy at the good news, their confidence that the move is timely, and that the new paper would be a mighty instrument for the promotion of Christian Science, that it would be a success from a business standpoint, and that they rejoiced to have this additional opportunity of assisting in your plans for the welfare of humanity. The exact nature of the new project was not announced immediately, but within a week or so, a notice appeared in the Sentinel to the effect that a large addition was necessary to the Publishing Society's building in Boston, and that all who desired to subscribe to this object could send their contributions to the church treasury in Boston. Without any further effort, the sum of $400,000 was subscribed within a few weeks. Additional land was purchased, and the work of constructing what was required in the way of new buildings and of strengthening existing buildings to the extent that they could carry the weight of the printing presses was commenced. Then, in October, appeared the formal announcement of the forthcoming appearance of the new daily, in which the trustees said, "It is their intention to publish a strictly up-to-date newspaper, in which all the news of the day that should be printed will find a place, and whose service will not be restricted to any one locality or section, but will cover the daily activities of the entire world. It will be the mission of the Monitor to publish the real news of the world in a clean, wholesome manner, devoid of the sensational methods employed by so many newspapers." Meanwhile, throughout the country, letters had gone out in all directions to newspaper men and women who were known to be interested in Christian Science, inviting them to send in their names to the Publishing Society, to the end that a suitable staff might be selected to serve on the new paper. The response was immediate and emphatic. Many hundreds of men and women from all parts of the country wrote in expressing their willingness to serve the new daily in any capacity. The work of selection must have been difficult. Nevertheless, it was carried through rapidly, and early in November, some 3 months after the trustees had received the first request from Mrs. Eddy, the new building was completed, the machinery installed, and the staff ready to commence work. Then, on November 25th, 1908, the day before Thanksgiving, the first issue of the Christian Science Monitor appeared. Mrs. Eddy attached great importance to the name, and especially to the point that the definite article should be an integral part of the title. Then she seems to have had quite a struggle to retain the words Christian Science in the title. Some members of the board of directors, and many others, were of opinion that the title should be simply The Monitor, without any indication as to the religious body that was sponsoring it. But Mrs. Eddy, while rigidly limiting the actual presentation of Christian Science teaching to one short article each day, was determined that the new daily should carry the name of Christian Science wherever it went. She spoke of it and wrote of it as the Monitor, but in any official reference, she insisted on the full title. In all this, Mrs. Eddy was consistent. Nothing seems to have aroused her more sternly to protest at any time than an appearance of sailing under false colors. In the far-off days in Lynn, she had boldly put up the blue and gold notice, "Christian Scientists Home," over the door. And she had been insistent to keep the words "Christian Science" in the forefront of her work ever since. Even up to the time that Archibald McClellan carried the proof of the first issue of the Monitor out to Chestnut Hill, he seems to have still had some hope that Mrs. Eddy would accept the point in regard to the name of the new periodical he and others were trying to make. But Mrs. Eddy once again left no doubt as to her wishes. On his return to Boston, McClellan made it clear to his colleagues that the matter was most certainly settled. "The name of the paper," he said expressively, "is the Christian Science Monitor." To her followers as a whole, Mrs. Eddy contented herself with a short notice which appeared in the first issue of the new paper, in which she related how she had given the name to all the Christian Science periodicals: The Journal, The Sentinel, Der Herald der Christian Science, and now The Monitor. "The object of The Monitor," she added simply, "is to injure no man, but to bless all mankind."